Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Tom Perata about his new novel, The Leftovers.
It is an event that resembles the Christian rapture, except for one major difference, and that's that it seems to be random.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Erica Heller reminisces about her father, Joseph Heller, author of Catch-22.
It was very hard to be upset with somebody that funny. It was usually at somebody's expense, but I grew up around that funniness.
And Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news. Tom Perata is not only one of America's best and most inventive novelists, he has a genius for capturing the zeitgeist. His new novel is called The Leftovers. It's reviewed on our cover by none other than Stephen King, who says Tom Perata is to the suburban enclaves of America what Sherwood Anderson was to Ohio. He praises Perata's beautifully modulated narrative and says his prose creates a rapture all its own. I'm delighted that Tom Perata is here to talk about his book. Welcome.
Oh, thank you, Sam.
Okay, so King is talking about the rapture. That's a good way to get into the story you're telling here. Just kind of set it up for us.
In this story, there's an event that takes place. It takes place in an unnamed year on the date of October 14th. And it is an event that resembles the Christian rapture, except for one major difference, and that's that it seems to be random. Millions of people throughout the globe have disappeared, but there doesn't seem to be any religious sense to it. And this creates a kind of ideological, theological, and personal crisis for the people who are left behind.
And you do something that major novelists often do when they're writing about the apocalypse, which is to write about the aftermath. So where has this left the particular characters you zero in on? What's the impact of this event?
As most novels are, the book's a microcosm, and it tries to tell the story of this event and this crisis through the lens of one suburban family. They're in a town called Mapleton. It's the Garvey family. And they represent a kind of spectrum of reactions to this event. So the father in this family is a guy named Kevin Garvey. He's been elected mayor to the town of Mapleton, and he is sort of the main force in town trying to get everybody to move on and resume living. He's basically saying it's not the end of the world, something terrible happened, but let's get on with our lives. Let's pick up, let's dust ourselves off, let's have a life again. His teenage daughter Jill is staying home with him. She is going through what could be a garden variety teenage rebellion, except that it seems very much related to the trauma that she'd suffered because she watched a friend of hers. Actually, she was present when a friend of hers disappeared. So they're the two who are staying and are living lives that appear that could have been lived before the event. But Kevin's wife, Lori, has had a very extreme reaction, and she's joined this suburban cult called the Guilty Remnant. They live across town in a sort of separate enclave. There are a couple hundred people living in this development. They dress in white. They smoke cigarettes constantly as a kind of proclamation of, they call it their faith, but it's also their lack of confidence in the future.
And meanwhile, as you say, you've created a microcosm, and things like this we begin to realize as we absorb the novel are occurring all over.
Yeah, it's a sort of a grassroots phenomenon where in a lot of different communities, people are forming chapters and following the same basic guidelines, but putting their own kind of local spin on this in terms of where they live and, you know, how they arrange their communities. And then the fourth member of the family is the son, whose name is Tom, and he's gone away to college and dropped out and sort of devoted himself to a charismatic healing prophet by the name of Holy Wayne. And his story is outside of the town of Mapleton, and it's about his disillusionment with the prophet and his slow emergence from that community into a different one.
Tom, let me quote you a sentence from your novel that Stephen King especially admired and is mentioned in the review. And King writes, when a suburban housewife recalls her husband's job-related BlackBerry obsession, his mind, and now he's quoting your prose, so absorbed in his work that he was rarely more than half there, a hologram of himself. Now, here thematically, we're doing something else. I mean, again, as major novelists do, you're taking what would seem an abstract or fanciful theme and actually winding it through the perceptions people have in their ordinary lives anyway, which is to say, if there was no rapture, that could still be true of her husband. So when you are describing, as you now do in this kind of famous way, the small lives of suburban people, and you take on a theme like this, are you saying that there already is a kind of huge departure or absence in the lives we're leading now without an event like this?
Yeah. I mean, the rapture always was a metaphor for me in this book. And, you know, when you're a novelist, there's that funny line you're walking. You want it to be literal so that it can be a metaphor. And you've got to work both sides of the fence. And in fact, you have to spend a lot more time making it seem literal and real and concrete so that you can then, I think, make it work on a metaphorical level. I don't think in my own mind that I was talking so much about voids in our cultural lives. I think I was talking much more about the way that we are always living with loss and always sort of left behind by loved ones and always in a state of kind of bewilderment about where they went and where we're going. And I was kind of using it as in my own mind, a kind of existential metaphor for loss.
Tom, some of your many admirers still have the idea of you as essentially comic novelist, and there are many funny passages in the book. But your last two novels, this and The Abstinence Teacher before The Leftovers, and I would argue actually Little Children before that, they're funny books, but they're also very serious, and there is a spiritual quality to them. Are you becoming a religious novelist?
I'm just growing older, I think, and feeling things that I haven't felt before. I think I lived a kind of a charmed life, and I think until I was well into my 40s, I felt young and I felt immortal. And since then, I've started to think about the second half of my life and the lives of my parents and the deaths of my father in particular. You know, you just change as you get older. I think it's the rare comic novelist who, I mean, Woodhouse somehow was the same writer from the beginning to the end. But most other comic novelists, I think, darken as they go.
Thanks so much, Tom.
No, thank you, Sam.
That's Tom Perata, whose new novel, The Leftovers, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. Julie Botsman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So, long-awaited memoir by Dick Cheney. It's out or almost out, or somehow you got a look at it.
We did get a look at it. The New York Times obtained a copy of the book. It is not officially out until next Tuesday, August 30th. That's the very strictly held embargo date. But we got an early look at the book, and what we see in the memoir, which is almost 600 pages long, is the Dick Cheney that we all know and love. It's often pugnacious in tone. It doesn't express much regret over the decisions that he made during his time as vice president. But he did talk about some of the decisions that he made, and he talked about some of the breaks that he had with President Bush.
Yes, Julie, from what I understand, the Vice President Cheney of the first term, an enormously powerful figure, maybe was not so influential in the second term?
That fits with the way that he described it. He said that, you know, as the second term went on, he began to be a bit more of an outsider within the administration, that he describes a scene when he's arguing that the United States should bomb a suspected Syrian nuclear reactor site. This is in June of 2007. And he writes that no one agreed with him. And in fact, President Bush said in the middle of a meeting, "Does anyone here agree with the vice president?" And as Vice President Cheney wrote, not a single hand went up around the room.
Julie, this book is being published just as the contest for the Republican presidential nominee is beginning to heat up. Is there a political aspect to this book, a contemporary political aspect as well?
You could argue that this is a book that a lot of people are going to pick up just as the campaign season really begins in earnest. So this book is sort of expected to sell very well among the same people who bought President President George W. Bush's book last November, which was, as you know, a huge blockbuster. So far, it's sold more than 3 million copies.
And Julie, what about a more kind of direct political role for this book? Does Mr. Cheney, for instance, comment on President Obama or the Democrats?
He does. In the book, Mr. Cheney praises President Obama's support when President Obama was a senator from Illinois for helping to pass a bank bailout bill at the height of the financial crisis, and that was shortly before the 2008 election. But Vice President Cheney also notes that President Obama has not yet closed the prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, which during the campaign he said very clearly that he would. So that's something that might be repeated as the campaign season goes on.
Now, Julie, this is a full-fledged memoir. We, of course, think of Dick Cheney, the vice president. He was a powerful figure, some say the most influential vice president in American history. But he had a long career before then, too. He was in Congress. He was a defense secretary under Gerald Ford. He was actually involved in the Nixon administration. Does he write about any of that?
He does. He said that this memoir was going to focus mostly on the last 40 years of his life. But he does, and he's 70 years old right now. But he does include a little bit of context about Dick Cheney as a young man. He talks about when he and his wife Lynn arrived at the University of Wisconsin as graduate students. He talks about how he wanted to be an academic, how that was, you know, his intention to be a professor. And he certainly talks about the political climate in Madison in 1969. And, you know, he does describe how he went to Washington thinking that it would be a brief stint there, and then he would return to Madison and finish his PhD and then go into academia. And obviously that didn't happen.
Is it well written? Is there a strong narrative? Is he an interesting writer, or are there any tics or, you know, aspects of style that you pick up when you read this, or is it not that kind of book at all?
It's not necessarily that kind of book. I mean, it reads in very much Dick Cheney's voice. He also had some help with the research from his daughter, Liz Cheney. But there are some more personal details. In the epilogue, Mr. Cheney describes when he had heart surgery last year, and this was a period where he was incapacitated and unconscious for several weeks. And he writes that during that period, he had a prolonged, vivid dream that he was living in an Italian villa where he paced the stone paths to get coffee and newspapers. So apparently in his dreams, he's a liberal.
Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Joseph Heller was one of America's greatest modern novelists, the author of Catch-22 and Something Happened, classics in our fiction. And his daughter, Erica Heller, is a very good writer, too. She's written a memoir called Yossarian Slept Here, When Joseph Heller Was Dad, The Apthorpe Was Home, and Life Was a Catch-22. It's reviewed for us by Blake Bailey, the distinguished biographer, who says Yossarian Slept Here is charming and telling. And Erica Heller shares her father's sense of humor and is a good writer herself. I'm delighted that Erica is here to talk about it. Welcome.
Hi.
It's interesting. Blake Bailey says you share your father's sense of humor, but many of our listeners will know that Joseph Heller more or less invented black humor in America. So do you have a dark sense of humor?
I think I must. I think I would have to. Assuming I have a sense of humor, it's probably quite dark.
Something our listeners will want to know about is the Apthorpe. Tell us about it.
The Apthorpe was an Astor building built in 1908, and it was quite beautiful and splendid for its time. Very large apartments when people started living in big apartment houses.
Upper West Side of Manhattan.
Upper West Side. And gradually, lots of artists and writers came to live there, even though it was the West Side, which was rather risky at the time. I was growing up there in the 50s, and it was dangerous. You could not go on side streets. That was one of the things you were told.
It was a dangerous neighborhood.
It was very dangerous. Came home from school with a lot of bloody noses, but this building was always beautiful and had just very, very elegant. It has a courtyard. It's very European looking. Over the years, I've left there and come back for various reasons at various times.
And why was it important to your family and your father?
I know it's where he had the idea for Catch-22, and I know he would work sometimes early in the morning and sometimes late at night. He had a job in the advertising business while he was writing it. It was a very splendid, I can't think of another word, place to live, to come home to every day. It was very imposing, very grand. Kids could play in the courtyard. And it was an interesting neighborhood to my parents at the time. And they were not afraid to live there.
Did that make it affordable, too?
Yes.
Because before...
It made it extremely affordable at the time. That's another thing, because I don't think they could have gotten anything as interesting for the amount of money that they were paying, which was quite reasonable.
Now, it's not a secret that great writers are not always the easiest people to live with, particularly to have as parents. And you've written an entire memoir about it, but tell us a little bit about what it was like to be the daughter of this enormously talented but also mercurial person.
It was very mixed, predictably. You never really knew what you were going to get. He could be very caustic. He could be very supportive. A lot of mood swings. The problem, as I see it now, after thinking about him a lot to write this book, is he was always really, really funny. It was very hard to be upset with somebody that funny. It was usually at somebody's expense, but I grew up around that funniness, and when I think of him, that's the first thing that comes into my head, not what kind of a parent he was. I don't think he was meant to be a parent. He really was not that interested in children. He had a quote, "I don't do children," which I think was from London or somewhere, but he was just always very, very funny.
You know, one of his novels that... isn't discussed quite so much these days. And a novel your father wrote called Good as Gold is stomach-hurtingly funny. I mean, it's kind of stand-up.
It hurts.
Yeah. And so that came naturally to him. But you also kind of suggest at certain moments in the memoir that he worked on some of these lines for a long time, too, or at least in some of his sharp responses and retorts. For instance, when he recruits or dragoons you with him in this ritual he had to deliver the manuscript, something happened, which was in some ways the magnum opus for him.
Right.
And you take it to a Xerox place and
Levy
tell that
Brothers.
Story.
Well, he would always take me with him in case he had a heart attack or was run over by a car. And it was, of course, pre-Xerox days. And so we would carry this huge box with a copy of the manuscript and a carbon copy. And I was supposed to walk behind him in case something happened to him. And I was supposed to grab the manuscript. And I'm not even sure do what with it. But as I say in the book, I'm not sure that would have been the first thing on my mind if something dreadful happened to him. But that was the plan. I was the backup because he always did anticipate disaster. I mean, that's the important part of that, I think.
Well, and there was not a disaster, but an awakening of some sort for you when you read the manuscript of Something Happened and found yourself in it, which is something else that literary figures do with families. And you're the daughter.
Yes.
Not always treated so kindly. And yet, when you raised this or thought about raising it with your father, his answer came.
The answer was, what makes you think that you were interesting enough to write about? So it was sort of either I was being written about in a terrible way or I was too boring to be written about. So there was no way really to win in that argument. But the most interesting thing to me now about Something Happened is that he always said it was not about him and it was not about us. And it was inconceivable to anyone in my family or who knew my family that it was not him and about us. But I think he honestly, in some way, actually believed what he was saying, which was that none of us had anything to do with it. And in some way, that allowed him to write it, I guess.
I haven't asked you about your mother.
Her relationship with him? Well, as long as she didn't want attention for herself and supported the whole myth of him, which was not a myth, I think she was a terrific wife, and they had a very good marriage. She knew him very well. And at some point, sometimes men don't want to be with the person who knows them that well anymore.
When did they meet, and where did they meet?
They met at Grossinger's right at the end of the war. He was back from Italy, and my mother was there with her mother and her younger brother who had been sick in the wintertime. And my grandmother, who
was... So this is the resort in the Catskills,
yes,
a famous resort.
Yes, yeah. It's as cliche as they come. And my grandmother saw him and heard him making jokes with his friends or something and said, literally, have I got a girl for you? He said, everyone I know has a girl for me. And she said, well, this one has red hair and freckles. And he said, the only thing I hate more than red hair is freckles. And
well, there's a promising beginning.
It was, yes. But my grandmother was only getting started, and they met at Grossinger's that week and stayed in touch and got engaged.
Our reviewer, Blake Bailey, who knows a great deal about literary biography, he's really written a couple of classics, one of Richard Yates and the other of John Cheever, says about your book, the miracle of this memoir is that it is never less than fair. Did it take a while for you to get to the point where you could be fair?
I'm not sure that I'm fair now, actually. I don't know. I mean, even just writing about it, I don't know if it's fair. I guess because of Something Happened, I always had an extra sensitivity about writing about people that you know. So it started out with me feeling terribly, terribly guilty because I thought everything I'm going to say is going to be hurtful to somebody or condemning something or judgmental. It was actually easier than I thought it would be. It wasn't easy to write, but things fell into place as I think I understood them, my parents, better.
Thanks so much, Erica. That's Erica Heller, whose memoir, Yossarian Slept Here, is reviewed in this week's book review. Jennifer Schuessler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
There is one new title on the fiction list, and as it happens, it is at number one. It is Terry Goodkind's Omen Machine. It is the 12th book in his epic fantasy cycle, The Sword of Truth. And as it happens, he is holding off a strong challenge from another installment in a rival epic fantasy cycle, George R.R. Martin's Dance with Dragons, which is the 5th book in his Song of Ice and Fire cycle.
Jenny, what about nonfiction?
Not a lot of action at the top here. J.C. Dugard still at number one with her memoir, A Stolen Life. Laura Hillenbrand still at number two with Unbroken. And let me give a little shout out for Charles Mann's 1493, his eco-history of the early settling of North America. It is at number five. And as it happens, The book he wrote before this, 1491, is back on the paperback list as well at number 13.
Well, he has started his chronology so early, if he does a book about every odd year, he can keep going for a very long time before he reaches the present.
Yes, he might end up writing as many words as George R.R. Martin.
Now, what about these atheist books I see?
Well, as it happens, there are a bunch of interesting new books at the bottom of the nonfiction list, starting with God No, a new book at number 14. No, it is not my memoir of my reactions to seeing the books that are on the bestseller list every week. It is sort of a memoir cum manifesto by the magician and outspoken atheist Penn Jillette. He is, as you probably know, the taller and much louder half of the magic duo Penn and Teller. And here he's written this kind of very rollicking and quite profane and mostly unquotable sort of account of his adventures in magic and in atheism. There are these sort of crazy accounts of these atheist baptisms he holds at his house in Las Vegas, which he calls the Slammer. And these tend to involve lots of eating of bacon, nude cornstarch wrestling, and, you know, fat Elvis impersonators, stuff like that.
Jenny, is this a trend? Are there other atheism books that are creeping up the list?
Well, as you know, this is sort of a big category. Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins have had huge bestsellers with their books. And I wouldn't say it's a big feature of a lot of other books on the list this week, but it sort of does. There are some other kind of interesting intellectual atheists on the list this week. For example, David Deutsch, the kind of great and very eccentric theoretical physicist, is at number 15 with his new book, The Beginning of Infinity, How Explanations Transform the World. You might recall this was reviewed in the book review a few weeks ago by the great quantum philosopher David Albert, and this is sort of a very hard-to-classify book about absolutely everything. It's about cosmology, it's about evolution, it's about philosophy, it's about language, very hard to describe. And, you know, Deutsch also is, you know, kind of quite skeptical of the idea of God, which he sort of sees as a meme, to borrow Richard Dawkins's term, sort of about these persistent ideas that kind of take hold in our brain and then are passed along through culture. And he doesn't see it as a particularly healthy or productive one. And then we've also got another David Eagleman, the neuroscientist from Baylor, who has been on the list for a few weeks now. He is at number 12 with his book Incognito. And as you might recall from a podcast a couple of months ago, in addition to being a neuroscientist, he's a fiction writer. He wrote a really interesting collection of sort of speculative stories a few years ago called Some. They were these sort of versions of the afterlife. And he sort of tried to launch a new religious identity. He calls himself a possibilian, which means that he aims to move past the dueling certainties of traditional religion and atheism to explore sort of radical what-ifs about the universe and human consciousness.
Hey, sounds like fun. So does God still sell any books?
Well, maybe not so much in hardback, but in other formats. For example, Heaven is for Real. You might recall this is about a preacher's 4-year-old son who has a near-death experience and then sees Jesus and John the Baptist and his dead great-grandparents. It is still at number one on the nonfiction paperback list and the nonfiction ebook list. So I guess these sorts of books have a kind of publishing afterlife.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.